Hello, good afternoon and good evening. Anybody there?
Hello.
Hey, there's Michelle. Laura? No, 831. Who's?
That's
It
Laura.
is Laura. Hello, Laura. Well, good afternoon, good evening. Good to hear from you both. As usual, my computer is playing tricks on me and not connecting as I think it should, so we're going to do this through the phone once again. Well, welcome everyone listening out there in Radio Land to our final module for spring 2015 of the Free Choice Learning at Oregon State sequence. This is the Physical Dimensions course, and we're happy to have you all here. So we're wrapping up this week, so we've got some time for students to ask us questions about their projects as they are frantically, hopefully not frantically, but quickly finishing up their final projects for the term. And we also have a special guest, Dr. Laura Good from Stanford Center for Ocean Solutions and formerly of the Oregon State Free Choice Learning Program, as many of us have been. So welcome, everybody. Always my cohort. Yeah. Glad that this is over, right? I thought today, I was like, I should have Michelle talk most of the time this time so no one has to listen to my craziness. So as always, my co-host Michelle Milam is joining us as well. So welcome, everybody. I am looking at the chat here, and it is being a pain in the butt, and so I'm not sure if anyone's on yet. Let's try it in a new window. Chat, nope. Open moderator chat. There we go. But while we're waiting, while I'm pulling it up, Laura, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're up to? She got her phone on mute. Maybe.
Give it a second.
She said hello. Uh-oh. Laura.
Maybe hang up and call back in. We had to do that in the last module.
Yeah, we did. It may be because I was connected after you all there. Okay, she's trying again. And we do have a guest in the chat room. Guest 994, you want to introduce yourself? If you have any questions for us, if you're a student or if you're a person from Blog Talk Radio Land, welcome. I'm not seeing anything. Well, so we're wrapping up this week a term of talking about how the physical setting in which people are learning can affect that learning, how well it happens or how poorly it happens if things are designed badly. And so I've got several great projects in the work from my students. Lots of variety of different kinds of projects. Some people working in museums, some people actually taking things out to the university quad to try out some exhibits there. And, so far nobody has had major issues, we'll say. A couple of people are still trying to identify sites, and we're working on that, but everyone's got some great ideas, and I'm really looking forward to what they've got. Michelle, how are your students coming along? They at that point yet?
I think as a lot of people are gearing up for, of course, the craziness that ensues in museum land come summertime, we have some people kind of slowly progressing, which I'm really happy to report, and some others who I think are still just at the stage of working out their proposal and trying to know and understand what they can do that really blends this into their normal job and duties. But we, like you, we have some really interesting things going on. I have one student who is looking at different environments for special needs students at an after-school program to try and understand how we can help students with those special needs engage in STEAM activities in a way that is more conducive to their learning needs. And we also have some interesting studies in art museums, and I think one at a nature center. So I'm excited to see what everybody pulls together here in the final weeks.
Yeah, me too. Me too. It'll be interesting. And even starting to read the discussions as people are posting, you know, frustrations that they're having, I think is going to be really useful for folks too. So, well, Laura, we think we might got you back this time.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Ah,
yes.
There she is.
Okay. I have no idea what was going on there.
We've had this issue throughout the term. I don't know if we're just not quite getting the hang of this yet, or you know,
we need to do some prototyping, Katie.
We do. But you know what? It was best. It was best in that silly McDonald's in Platonia, Texas, because I'm back in my office today and we're having craziness. So I don't know what it is. I don't know, but. Anyway, that just tells you something about the university wireless, I suppose. So, Laura, we did get a question about about one student's project, so I'm going to try and address that real quickly before we get to you. And we have another guest, it looks like, that's joined us. I don't know if that guest would like to sign in and tell us who they are, and if they have a question about their projects. And Laura, please feel free to chime in as we go. If you have input on these projects, we'd love to hear it. So I will let you all know that Laura did this class, I believe, the same time I did a few years ago. And so if you've seen the photos of the footprints in the Hatfield Marine Science Center, that was a result of Laura's prototyping years ago. Isn't that right?
Yep, that is. Yeah, some of the first prototyping I did for, I believe, this class, actually, when I took this class. So there you go.
Yeah, I think so. All right. So Amber asks, after doing first two rounds of testing, she's taking a completely different direction. However, which is great, because I think that's one of the things I recognize in my student projects is that, you know, we would have them propose the ways they might alter things, but we really wanted them to remain open to whatever the data would tell them as they collected it. So that's perfect that you're going to take a completely different direction if that's what the data is telling you, Amber. And then she finishes, however, the exhibits can only help me make two major changes to the space on the same day. Is it okay that I test those two changes combined? Aha. Well, I guess without knowing a little more about what you mean, Amber, I'm not sure. But I would say that if you've done two rounds of testing, probably just one change that's based on your data is going to be fine. And so I would not worry about testing both of them. I would just, you know, say that, you know, for this third round, I'm going to do this one and hope that you pick the right one. I don't know. Michelle, Laura, do you have any input on that?
Yeah, I agree with you, Katie. I think you wouldn't want to change, especially if you think that there are two big ideas that are impacting usability at the same time. I would just choose one or the other. And of course, if this was a more thorough study, you would probably change one, get data, change the other, maybe change both at the same time. But, you know, for the sake of the course, I agree with you, Katie. Choose one, hope, you know, you get something out of that, and just write up the context of the other piece and what you think may have been different if you had tested that piece.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's true. So she's, okay. So she's saying this is in the entryway. One would be including a live information desk, and I guess the second would be shifting a pillar so that they can enter and move to a particular area. So Amber has been looking at, I think, trying to get people to better use a particular space that's harder to access. And one of the things is that, you know, the map is not very good. So Amber, if I'm remembering that correctly, you know, those seem kind of different. And I would say that it might be, if the data you've collected so far is telling you more that the map is a problem, I would say maybe including the live info desk, although I'm not quite sure what you mean by that. But if you're otherwise finding that people sort of use the map, but they really can't physically get into the space, then I would go with shifting the pillar. So do a little more directions, feel free to chat in if you've got another question or more follow-up to that. We've got a couple more folks on the chat that have not signed in, so I'm not quite sure if they are students or if they're folks from Blog Talk Radio land. Great either way. Students, if you have questions on your final projects or really any projects that you might be catching up on in the term, you know, feel free to chat in and ask us now. Our guest is here to also help us answer your questions. Amber follows up with, it was a live info desk in place of the touchscreen orientation kiosk. So, okay. So, yeah, I guess if that's the case, Amber, you know, we can definitely talk via email, but if you're talking about a live person in place of the touchscreen orientation versus moving the pillar, I would say that the live info desk is moving a little more towards not being just a physical design measure. And so then I might say, actually, I'd say shift the pillar instead. Plus, if you're thinking about being the live information provider at the same time, that's going to be hard for you to collect data on. And, I mean, a live person, frankly, is going to be sort of a much more interactive component than just shifting the physical environment. So unless you've really got some more detail that you can share that I'm really understanding, I'm going to say I would go with just the pillar, change that, and then, you know, three rounds of testing. Assuming you've got a fair number of participants for each of those, for the purposes of the final project, that's plenty, and I would stop there. So anybody else want to chime in on that? Michelle, Laura, does that sound about right?
No, that sounds about right to me. I agree about the not substituting for the person, because you're talking about getting into social and personal dimensions of free choice learning that it's going to be harder to account for in terms of what patterns you notice after you make that change. So just sticking to the more straightforward non-human pieces makes sense.
Great. Well, our other guests are remaining quite silent for the moment, so I will remain on the chat and we can come back to student questions in a little bit, but why don't we take the time to reintroduce our guest and have her share with us some of her experiences. So those of you who might have been following along closely earlier in the term, we were hoping to have Dr. Good come on and talk to us in our Module 3 about emotions and our senses, because Dr. Good worked for several years in YMCA or Boys and Girls Camps, she can tell you correctly, but in real out of doors environmental spaces that I think you could really bring your senses into play. But so we'd love to hear a little bit about that, Laura, kind of also where you've taken your career since being in the Free Choice Learning Program. And, you know, since we're wrapping up this week and talking about kind of connections with the other dimensions, also feel free to address all three dimensions. So, you know, tell us who you are and take it away.
Okay, well, thank you, Katie. Thank you for having me on this show. I'm sorry that I wasn't able to make it earlier in the term. But life is life and situations occur, so I'm here now. So I am basically, where I work right now is for Stanford University, but I work for an organization that is under the administration realm of Stanford called the Center for Ocean Solutions. Basically, the Center for Ocean Solutions is a boundary organization. We work to help better integrate science into decision-making for ocean policy to move towards better solutions for environmental problems that are related to the ocean, hence our name. I myself come under the leadership development realm of our work, which is basically better preparing emerging leaders so that they can be more help, essentially, in that process. So working with graduate students in particular in providing them with different professional development experiences around things like collaboration, communication, innovation, so that they can be more part of these science into policy conversations, which is a really, really interesting realm of education work. I coordinate what's called the MARINE program. MARINE is an acronym. It stands for the Monterey Area Research Institutions Network for Education. It is a backwards acronym. And basically what we are is a collaboration between the Center for Ocean Solutions and seven Monterey Bay Area university campuses in California that works together to provide these different professional development experiences. So we're out there to enhance graduate marine education, and we kind of are on the ground, really, in terms of the different trainings and professional development opportunities we provide. We essentially get these students talking, first of all, which is a really big deal. You'll be surprised how many graduate students do not talk to other graduate students in similar fields across different universities, and that's a really important part of this type of work.
So virtual and physical silos there, right?
Absolutely, yes. So the work I do right now, it is very much related to free choice learning. The participation that the graduate students get involved in with the program is off their own back. They've got to do this on top of their, you know, their regular degree work. And they're doing it to kind of add a different dimension to their work and to be able to be more applied in their work as well. As I'm sure many of us are aware, when you go to school, you do gain very strong knowledge in an academic sense, but you don't necessarily get pushed in kind of the leadership type of skills that you might need to be able to apply that work somewhere else, particularly if you're interested in a non-academic job. Which in the free choice sector, a lot of people are interested in non-academic jobs. Where I've come from is in outdoor education. So as Katie mentioned, I worked for the YMCA of Greater New York for probably about, I think it was about 6 years. And there I did everything from being a pretty straight up camp counselor all the way through to a summer program director. And I did summer programs there, but I also did outdoor education. So during the year, I was basically a naturalist, and I would lead different outdoor education programs for visiting school groups. And when I was a graduate student, I continued some of that, working for what Oregon State University calls pre-college programming, which is basically encouraging middle and high school students to actually envision themselves as college students and envision themselves being able to take their learning to a different level. So I've done a lot of different types of free choice work. I have done museum work as well, of course. In fact, my research was based in that. But part of the reason I'm into free choice learning is because I love the scope of what you can get involved in terms of people learning in their everyday life and what that means for their future. So was that a good little background spiel there, Katie? Do you need any more depth for that?
Oh, that's great. So we do have a specific question for you for your work previously. Jenny East wants to know if you can recall a time while you were working in the camps or, frankly, probably in any of your experiences, but maybe particularly when you were working outdoors somewhere, where you took advantage of the physical environment for a teaching learning opportunity that may have been planned or may or may not have been pre-planned. And she says, you know, so from her experience, you have to adapt quickly to your surroundings, whether for safety reasons or others, so you learn to think quickly on your feet. So you got any experience you can share?
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, I think that's my favorite part of being in this type of education is the opportunities that present themselves, the physical opportunities that present themselves that allow you to have what I call teachable moments, or a lot of people call teachable moments. So a good example is when I was a naturalist for the YMCA, we would do a lot of different trail activities where we would, you know, lead interpretive hikes and things like that. And things would happen. You're out on the trail, a bear would show up, or a deer would poop in front of you, or something along those lines. A tree would fall down. That happened once or twice while I was out on trails. And we would, it's interesting that Jenny brought up the safety issue. Yes, you have to pay attention to the fact that you're looking after children in an outdoor environment, but you could really always use those moments to the benefit of the group, either teaching them about the animal that's presented itself or teaching about the nature of the forest that was around you, asking them questions about whether they'd had this experience before. You know, they were definitely the most useful moments that I came across as an outdoor ed instructor. And in later years, in terms of the physical, I mean, the physical factors of what's going on, you, they kind of add context to what you're talking about. You know, even now when I'm working with graduate students and I may be leading a communication training for them, usually I'm doing it at some marine lab somewhere that's surrounded by an ocean. You know, getting the students out and about and actually being able to remember why they're learning about this stuff in the first place brings about some really great emotional responses to what you're talking about. So, for, like I said, for me, the physical pieces of an educational location, I guess maybe is the best way to put it, of whatever your classroom is, really adds emphasis to what you're trying to explain and what you're trying to engage those students in.
Great. So are you having any different experiences, would you say, with those graduate students as more, you would think, at least adult-type audiences than some of the camp audiences? I'm also thinking of the time we went on a lab retreat, and I believe it was you and Susan took us on a night hike where we were using a lot more of our senses other than sight. And yet we were also all a bunch of very independent adults, and you guys were trying to wrangle us, and that was more or less successful sometimes.
Yeah, that was a challenging evening. Yes, there's obvious differences between working in the camp environment and working in this more kind of academic environment. But no, there's not in some regard. The way I see it is engagement, and engagement is about getting wide eyes to what you're talking about or kind of creating those aha moments for people. And a lot of it for me, in terms of that engagement, it is helping people step outside their box a little bit. And in the camp environment, that was very much the case. We worked with a lot of urban youth because it was upstate New York, so we used to have a lot of New York City kids come to us. Kids who perhaps hadn't really had those experiences in the past and were maybe somewhat fearful of it in a way, and we used to have to take them, help them feel more comfortable with that. In the academic sense, you know, some of the students I work with, they're very focused on their academic development. They're very focused on getting that degree, getting those boxes checked, getting out the door. And sometimes they need a moment or two to kind of remember why they're doing that in the first place and what they want to do with the information that they're gathering. You know, they're trying to make it big in their world, but we've got to be happy while we're doing it, right? So, you know, the aha moments, the teachable moments are really kind of the times I feel where I make the biggest connection with the learners that I work with, but also that they're making the biggest connection to their interests and to the world around them. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. Looks like Jenny's on the chat. She hasn't really added anything to there, so I think that's exactly the sort of thing that we're looking to get at. So the last module here is kind of wrapping up what we talked about with the physical and starting to talk about, you know, integrating it with the personal. And obviously the emotional and sensory part is very much connected to the personal and can be to the social, of course, as well. That's really, you know, getting to the heart of what this really is. And I've said, I think before, you know, we talk about these 10 or 11 weeks on each of these like dimensions, as if we could separate them from the others and as if we could really look at them in isolation, but obviously we can't. And that's, you know, part of the joys and challenges, I think, of as well, of working in in free choice learning or working in education and learning in general is there's so many variables. And coming from a bench scientist, I was a biologist as an undergraduate. You know, we would talk about control, and even talking about some of the real effectiveness trials in school and, you know, how to make random assignment and account for every factor and control everything you can. I mean, it's just kind of impossible. And I think the beauty of this free choice perspective is that we're actually not trying to control for that. We're trying to understand it and look at it in a real systematic, but also holistic perspective. So that's great to hear that. Jenny is saying, yep, that's really getting to the heart of her question too. And so I'll remind everyone that we are at our last radio show for SED 584, Module 5 for the Physical Dimensions of Free Choice Learning in Spring 2015. So this is an opportunity for folks to talk both with our guest, Dr. Laura Good, and with us about your final projects. So we got another question for Dr. Good here on the chat, but I encourage you to send in both questions for Dr. Good and for if you have anything related to your project, because we certainly have time to talk about those as well. So Matt asks, what are some of the wide-eyed experiences, particularly examples that you might say involve physical interaction in some way, and particularly that you might use with grad students or young kids? And he says that any of us can answer that, but since Dr. Good is our guest, I'll let her go ahead and go first.
That involve physical interaction in some way. Apart from some of the ones that I just mentioned in terms of things that happen in the environment around you, like a good example was we were teaching a course a few weeks ago about whale ship strikes and kind of the wicked problem of whale ship strikes and how to move forward with solutions for it. And the classroom was right on the waterfront there in Moss Landing in California, and a humpback whale breached right outside the window right there. In the classroom, some of the graduate students were from the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. And then being naval students, they're highly technical. They don't, the work that they're doing is very focused on kind of the national security issues that they deal with, and the equipment and the engineering that they're part of. And a lot of them kind of was like, oh, wow, it's a humpback whale. You know, I've got a chance to now have a conversation about a humpback whale, brought on an emotional response. So in that way, I mean, I'm not bringing out the humpback whale for everybody to use, as interesting as that might be. It brings itself out. But I guess the physical interaction with the environment would be, teaching in an environment where potentially teachable moments can happen. If you're in an environment where it's not a dynamic learning environment, be it whether that means you can encourage interaction between the participants or interaction with objects like biofacts, the term biofact that we use in museums to describe like things like shells or bones or something that we can explain a concept or an idea with by something tangible, giving the visitor something tangible. If you don't have those kind of around and in place, then you're going to limit the type of interactions your learners are going to have with that environment. And I would say that most outdoor educators will agree with me in the sense that it's very difficult to teach about the environment and about the outdoors if you're not outdoors. You need the random moments, or you need the opportunity for the students to touch the grass or touch the trees, have a conversation about how cold it is outside, or how cold the water is that they're touching if they're doing something like pond ecology or something like that, for them to actually understand what you're talking about. So I would say whatever you can do to bring context to the physical environment that you're attempting to describe. In a museum environment, you know, the exhibits do a variety of different ways that they bring that on. They use sound, they use smell, they use immersion type experiences, you know, where you go into a dark room and there's things that you can touch that you can't see and stuff like that. It's basically going back to kind of this idea of not having a stagnant environment for a person to interact in the first place, I guess.
Yeah, it's funny how, you know, sort of thinking about different models of schools, and, you know, I hate to sound like I'm contrasting free choice with schools, because, you know, I wrote a whole article that's like, well, we really don't want to be pitting each other against one another, but you can imagine the opposite of free choice. Or an opposite of a stimulating environment is, you know, just that, you know, a bare empty room with nothing going on, and, you know, but I think about sometimes we privilege activities and experiences for kids, you know, thinking that, well, they need all this stimulus and they need all this like stuff so that they can learn, and it's almost like we forget that we keep learning, and so we, like, don't have a lot of, don't offer ourselves a lot of stimuli and, you know, maybe have certainly boring and dull cubicles that, you know, sometimes people are restricted from even
stimulating.
And how can that lead to a creative environment where people are stimulated and certainly learning and learning from others and doing productive work? Well, maybe that's when you're horrible telemarketing job or something, but wow, it just doesn't seem like they're solving people's problems creatively that way, but maybe that's on purpose.
It's true, yeah. I mean, if you think about the nature, the extent to which companies like Google and there's a shoe company that is leaving my attention. Michelle, you should be able to answer this question for me. The shoe company that's based up in Portland, they've gone to great lengths to, like, change their work environments for exactly that reason, to move away from the cubicle system, to have regular points where their employees interact and converse about different ideas, but also to have fun things around them that encourage creativity all the time. Yeah, we do have a tendency to think, oh, we're adults, you know, we get to do the boring stuff, but it's not really the way it goes. A good example is when I was teaching this course a few weeks ago, I was doing some team building activities with the students, and some of these things were a little bit silly. They were a little bit, you know, they were to break down barriers. They were icebreaker types of activities, and some of the students generally had kind of a funny attitude towards it. Like, we're adults. Why are we playing with Play-Doh? Or why are we using Lego? You know, it's almost like it's like the way we think about education as we get older is that it sort of changes because we're adults. But in a way, it really doesn't. I mean, maybe we don't need as much stimulus, but we still need to have the opportunity to be able to be creative and get excited about something. I mean, how can you learn about something if you're not interested in it? It's very difficult to.
Right. Yep. Very good. Matt says it's probably Nike, right, that you're thinking of?
It's not Nike. It's another one. It'll come to me soon. It's blue. I know, just the logo is blue, but that's not helping. I can remember the color more than the name.
Jenny also says that Microsoft has revised some of their buildings. And, of course, Apple. Steve Jobs was, like, famous for that, right? So... and apparently the Bishop Museum, Amber says that they adjusted their science education office to be more open too. So these are all great spaces that, you know, in all of our free time, you know, we'll all be able to evaluate and prototype and everything for sure. So,
At Stanford University too, they did very similar things. There was a whole initiative to update the building so that they were encouraging innovation, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Cool. yeah, that's fabulous. Michelle, are you back with us? She's been having a noisy dog. I was going to see if...
I'm trying to find the quietest spot in my house. There's a lot going on here today, and she is being very vocal. I apologize if you can hear it. I also just wanted to add something on while I'm unmuted about what Laura was saying about engaging adults. And I think especially if we turn the conversation to bridging all three context of the contextual model of learning, is I very much think that is the role of the educator or the museum interpreter, is to get adults past that, to get them past the filter that they apply to themselves. I feel like that's just the best way to describe it, that they can't do something. Like, this is designed for kids. You know, we see it a lot at touch pools where they can touch live animals. Adults are almost just as fearful as some of the kids. and it's not the fear that the animal is going to hurt them. It's just that fear, like, I'm an adult. I don't know if I can play in that kind of way. And I think that's the role of the educators, kind of break people past that point and to really get them to fully engage and understand that you are still learning and that it's okay to engage in activities in that manner. So I think that's kind of a nice overall piece, blending the personal, the sociocultural, and the physical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, one thing I always say a lot to the students I work with is that, you know, I challenge them to rethink the way they think about their own education and their own learning. When, you know, if you Google right now the word education or learning, you get a bunch of images that are associated with things like desks and classrooms and apples with teachers and things like that. You know, we all know as education students that that's not necessarily what education is. It's a whole lifelong learning experience that's filled with a very diverse set of different experiences that involve a very diverse set of physical attributes. But culturally, we've kind of become a little bit conditioned to believe that education is just walking into a classroom and learning something, which is just fine. There are, of course, dynamic classrooms too, but they're, you know, it's an important thing to remember as an educator and when you're planning some kind of educational activity, is what your participants anticipate is going to happen and how you can help them kind of maybe overcome some of their own barriers that they put in the way of that. And you can use physical objects to do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think Michelle makes a good point that things like the touch tanks are a good way to maybe, they're pretty inviting and open, you know, if you think about, so I'm particularly at Hatfield, but others that I've visited too, I mean, it's actually designed, you know, for that and designed as an open multi-user space, which frankly, some of our quote unquote interactive exhibits are not, you know, we talk about Or I've tried to talk about, you know, really getting groups to engage. And it's funny, some evaluation I did of the Magic Planet, so if you all remember me talking about this earlier, the spherical design, spherical display, one of the things, you know, we thought it would afford was that people could walk around and see all sides of it. And especially groups might be able to walk around and, like, share with each other. So one thing that we noticed when we were just evaluating it, and this was not prototyping, but this might be able to, you know, what you all are working on, and certainly to this larger discussion, first off, you know, often people would bring stools over, because we did have a kiosk that was supposed to, that was on one quote-unquote side of it, that you could interact and change the images on the globe. But so people would come over and sit down on these stools and just start using the kiosk, and they wouldn't walk around. So we made a couple of adjustments that actually helped people somewhat to do that. So in some of the exhibit text, we did say, walk around to the other side and take a look. You know, and then we also, every time I was in there, I would take the stools away. I would not have the stools there so that people would be standing. But when I was doing my observations of people, even when I asked them to, like, use the exhibit, they would stand on the side with the kiosk, and they wouldn't walk around except for this one group. And I have to say, based on their accents, they were not from the U.S., you know, and I don't know if it's a cultural thing or if it was just that group, but it really struck me thinking about that, that the rest of, most of the rest of my participants didn't go around unless they were specifically invited. And maybe that's an American thing. We're always told and we follow directions and we, you know, are very much, maybe it's the way we use museums, you know, especially art museums. Don't touch has been a long-standing thing, and science museums and science centers are a more recent phenomenon. I just think really you're right. A way we've been brought up, a lot of us, and breaking those barriers is a tough thing.
Yeah, and it's you know, and giving learners the opportunity to challenge the way that they are being taught is you know, in whatever environment that is. Or even how they teach themselves in some regard, you know, is a good strategy, I think. I always remember, for example, when I was running a marine science camp over at Hatfield Marine Science Center, I was running a summer day camp for them, and I was encouraging the students to come up with some research questions or some questions that they might want to, you know, uncover or find the answer to about particular marine animals that they were interested in. And I said to them, you know, some of them asked me this question about theories. I don't really remember how we got into that conversation, which is pretty cool coming from a bunch of sixth and seventh graders. You know, I said to them, you know, one thing you have to remember is that theories are theories and science isn't necessarily fact. There might be an overwhelming amount of evidence that suggests that something is likely to be a fact, like gravity, for example. I was like, but it's okay for you to challenge whatever, you know, what you want to challenge. It's fine for you to ask questions. It's fine for you to ask somebody who's teaching you about something, you know, how they know whether that's correct or if they can do, you know, if they can interact with something more so they can find out more about it. So yeah, I mean, museums are a classic example of it. If you go into art museums or, you know, history museums where you've got the do not touch signs, like you said, Katie, it's an understandable approach for artifacts that they're trying to maintain, but there are other ways for people to engage in that piece rather than just staring at it and maybe even just having a conversation about it, which I'm sure many of the students in this class have started to notice doing their rounds more and more around different museums and whatnot, because we have started to notice that there is different approaches that different museums take now towards exhibits or putting things on display.
Yeah. Well, and Jenny East also mentioned that she was walking through the library at Oregon State and randomly overheard a student sitting with a group, and the student declared, "Learning is not linear." And she said her visitor her ears perked up, but she wasn't able to do an on-the-spot focus group. So I think you're right. I think as our students in this class reflect, they ought to realize that they are noticing these things more and more, and that's ultimately what we want you to get out of these courses is, you know, some examples. So when you're conducting your radio shows in 4 or 5 years, you're like, oh, yeah, and now I remember that time. And, oh, yeah, now I remember that time. And have all these great examples, and it's starting to gel even when you're not necessarily thinking about it. So, Jenny also mentioned that they didn't have stools around the touch table. The Surface computer that she was working with at her in her thesis and in some of her prototyping, but people do pull them from other exhibits to sit and for little kids to stand on. So, I mean, you know, you're fighting with John Fox's like idea of museum fatigue, and you definitely want people to be comfortable, but it's sometimes that the loss of or in conflict with using perhaps all the way that the exhibit could be used. So,
mm-hmm.
Yep.
There,
so,
there is something to be said there, though, about in those kind of situations where, you know, we have expectations of ourselves, of the learning environment around us as educators, and we, you know, we do anticipate certain things to happen. We anticipate something. We don't anticipate others. But, you know, that's Jenny's example. There is an important data point. And what you're saying is what they're uncovering is a need that they feel that they, you know, it's something that they feel that they need, sorry. And that's something to take into consideration, which is, again, why it's important for, you know, whatever type of activity, you know, education activity you're encouraging learners to participate in, you give them the chance to give you feedback on the environment they're in and whether they can actually do something different than perhaps you expected them to do with the materials that are placed in front of them.
Yeah. I think that you're open to lots of different types of feedback, you know, like no one would probably say I'm going to observe the number of times that someone is going to pull a stool to my exhibit, but you certainly observe when it happens a few times and then you're like, oh, well, mm-hmm. What could that mean? What need are we missing? And then you might be able to. And so that's really the essence of prototyping and what I'd like to drive home with projects is really letting the data drive where you're going. And so that's kind of a good segue. We have about 12 or 13 minutes left. No one has chatted in their questions on projects, so I want to be sure that you get the chance to do that. Certainly this is, you know, kind of our last live discussion that will offer that, and we do have Dr. Laura Good here who can offer her perspective as well. So be sure and let us know if you have questions on those final projects. Like I said, the things that I was seeing that are going to be the hardest obstacles, I think, for students to overcome if they don't solve this up front is really having a well-defined task that you're trying to evaluate and trying to improve. And then also just really remaining open to what your data tells you and making your changes based on that. And maybe a little bit of what we were talking about with Amber is maybe recognizing after a couple of rounds that what would be ideal is really having a live person there, but to stick to kind of the physical things that you can actually change. Because, you know, in reality, we don't always have a fully interactive person there. And, you know, it's kind of expensive to have a fully interactive person there. So, and, you know, for the purposes of this class, we're looking at the physical dimensions. So, So Amber shares something regarding the stools around her Science on a Sphere exhibit, which is similar to the Magic Planet at Hatfield. Which is no longer at Hatfield, I hear. So she says they had that happen all the time with stools, that visitors would bring them over while waiting for the planetarium show because it's in their entranceway where people line up and wait for the planetarium shows to start. And so she said they made movable benches so that the stools didn't keep going walkabout. I don't think she meant that people were taking stools home, but maybe they got missing from other places that they really were supposed to be or that the exhibit folks needed them to be at some particular time. But that's kind of a funny, like, opposite example of what we were saying. People don't want to touch the exhibits, but I guess they're really free with moving the furniture and the stools around. They're okay with that. So Matt says, OMSI Portland is designed to appeal to a younger age group for the most part, but some aspects seem to interest adults and bore the kids. Is there a happy medium to find here? Well, my first comment on that is that I would be curious to ask the exhibit designers because I would imagine that they are actually aiming for a happy medium. It's definitely a tricky thing. And I would say one of the problems that we have is that adults may not see themselves as users of science museums without kids. Mm-hmm. So So we're kind of forced to design spaces. And you know, there's not a lot of cases where you're going to have kids on their own without adults. I mean, you might have some cases where there's big school groups and there are fewer adults to every kid. But, okay, you know, Michelle, Laura, you want to jump in here?
Yeah, I mean, oh dear, this is one of those things that educators in a variety of different realms have been struggling with for a long time when they're dealing with multi-generational family groups. It's, it's trying to find a balance of activities or exhibits or whatnot that you're presenting that actually please everybody. It's not an easy thing. It's not an easy thing at all. And again, it kind of comes back to the idea of the objects that you're putting in front of them, if the child doesn't view it as something that they can play with per se, and you know, and work both ways, if it's something an adult feels that they shouldn't be playing with because they're an adult, then that will make it difficult for them. So some children's museums have some of this difficulty too because they're designated as children's museums. But in fact, they're really family museums. They're places where you take the adults with you. You can't have just children in there on their own. From my past experience with the YMCA, we used to have a similar issue with family camps, with family programming. Whenever I think of family camp, people always think of like Dirty Dancing and that type of family camp. It's kind of more like structured camp programming, but not like Dirty Dancing and things like that. But family camps have a similar thing. It was very difficult when I was a program director to get the balance of activities that you would offer right, you know, and some would be designated as children's activities and some would be designated as adult activities based on whatever, you know, the materials they were interacting with. It really comes down to how you present those materials, I think. Sometimes it's just and Michelle is going to laugh at me and Katie's going to laugh at me because I'm going to say my age-old thing. It's just a case of being explicit that they can use it, you know. Everybody can use this. Everybody can play here. So,
that's actually honestly true. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, though, Laura, is everybody can use it because being the person who will go to a children's museum, sans children, I will, my sister and I as adults would, I think every time I visit her in Tallahassee, we would go to the children's museum there, partly because it was a fantastic hands-on museum and mm-hmm. we would still get a lot from it. And I think is what it comes down to is partly culture of the place mm-hmm. as to whether or not you as a visitor, no matter if you're visiting alone in a multi-generational group or what, you kind of soak in that surrounding culture of what it is you should be doing there. Mm-hmm. And I think that just is so individualistic to each museum and particularly each children's museum. To how engaging children feel at certain parts and how engaging adults feel at certain parts. So mm-hmm. that's a big part of it, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think this is kind of like a perfect wrap-up to this term because, you know, we almost, if not careful, you can structure even a graduate course in free choice learning as something that has all structures. And you got these three PhDs here, you know, talking about like offering all their wisdom, and yet there are huge problems that need to be addressed and maybe, you know, ultimately insolvable. But I think this is exactly the crux of like what we are all in our work trying to do is find experiences that, you know, explicitly invite and engage everyone in multiple different ways. And you know, Matt also commented that he sees kids playing on tablets and cell phones, and it's hard to compete with that immersion. And that's just it, is that it's that immersion and flow that we really want people to get at with these hands-on experiences. And free choice learning doesn't have to be hands-on. It doesn't have to be in a museum, of course. But, you know, mm-hmm. what can engage people, you know, in that way and really move them forward in whatever way. So,
you know, there's a lot of talk in the museum world about this question for, you know, competing with games, and we're trying to find ways to work, but hey, museums may be obsolete in another, who knows, but hopefully, you know, hopefully not, but hopefully in a larger sense, we figure out, you know, what it is that really is offering these people a meaningful experience and how we can facilitate that. And it's an open question.
For me, you know, be it that I've come from the free choice learning world, that for me, what I try to bring about in all the different educational activities that I'm involved in planning or facilitating or whatnot, or even doing myself, I try to encourage people to be the rulers of their own destiny in terms of learning, and to encourage them to think harder about what they want to learn, why they want to learn, how they want to learn, how they learned in the past, things like that, so that they feel like they have more ownership and they see what they're learning on more on this lifelong learning spectrum, which I think is the beauty of the conversations that we have in free choice learning, is that it's very user-centered. And I'm trying to encourage the users that I encounter to be in more in control of that, to have more control over their learning. And it doesn't matter what environment that is in.
Doesn't matter what physical setting you put it in, right? Well, we are coming to our last 3 minutes of the show. It is hard to believe that the quarter has flown so quickly. I want to be sure and thank Dr. Laura Good for joining us, offering her perspective, reminding all of my students that your projects are due next week, except for those of you who I've worked out other arrangements with. I'm still going to be checking email, as will Michelle. So as you have questions on those projects, let us know. Feel free to, I mean, also use the discussion boards. I'm really seeing some good stuff talking amongst my students on that, on your final projects. Michelle, do you have anything to say about final projects or other projects?
I don't. I encourage everybody to just keep moving forward, especially my certificate students. Like Katie, I will be in contact. I'll actually be working on the free choice learning program over the summer, so I will be on regularly and around. So I know some people do need more long-term extensions for their final projects, but keep at it. And if anything, these have been wonderful conversations that we've had here on the radio show. So I really enjoyed it this term.
Great, great. Well, I thank you all for participating and for chatting in. We had a whole five people, well, four, I guess it was four students and me at our peak today. And I think this has really been a great discussion and a real good wrap-up to the term. And maybe, Laura, that it worked out for the best that you joined us this week instead of a couple weeks ago. So we're glad that you just
took
care of
everything. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate you bringing me on the conversation. So it's good. It's good stuff.
And students, you know, as you have questions beyond the course, and if you have questions for our presenters over the course of the term, you know, I can get you in contact with them and that sort of thing. Let me take this opportunity to say it's been great, you know, being your instructor this term and working with Michelle on this all quarter. And, you know, I look forward to working with you all professionally in other capacities, and I hope we continue these conversations at conferences and things. So, yeah. Anybody else want the final word? 25 seconds?
No, that's all you, Katie.
I'll chime and not get cut off. We've got thanks for everyone, especially to Laura for all your insights. And Jenny says, nice to hear your voice again, Laura.
And yours, Jenny. Bye, tech.
And I'm going to take this opportunity to sign us all off. Happy 2015, everyone. All right. Well, I guess we still record and a little bit, and Laura, you're still on the phone for a second, so I finally figured out how to finish this radio show on time, huh?
But only five of them.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. It was really great to interact with you again. So see you later.
It was
Thank
fun.
Thank you.
See you both later.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye. Okay. Bye.